Please be seated. Third case of the day, State versus Jeffrey Mosier, 19 AP 2184. Appearances, please. Good afternoon. All right, good afternoon. Lineup's 25 minutes, followed by 30 and 5 minutes in rebuttal, right? Okay, please proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'm Attorney John Baer. I represent Mr. Jeffrey Mosier in this matter. I'm going to begin with just a little history of how I believe this motion came to be. In 2013, Missouri v. McNeely was issued by the United States Supreme Court. That fundamentally changed the procedure in OWI cases when the defendant or the suspect that's accused of OWI refuses consent to the blood draw. Prior to McNeely, the officers did not need a search warrant in the typical case. The officers used to routinely, in those situations, be able to draw blood through an exception to the warrant requirement, exigent circumstances. The exigent circumstance was rapid metabolization of alcohol in the human body. Missouri v. McNeely changed that. And so now there is a need, I believe, and that's why we're here, to define the way, because the way that the officers, the procedure that's used to obtain search warrants to draw blood. Now if somebody refuses, the officers have to have a system in place to be able to get a warrant pretty quickly, or at least in a time-efficient manner, sometimes in the middle of the night, a lot of the times, I should say, in the middle of the night. What I've been noticing, because I'm a defense attorney who practices pretty much exclusively for OWIs, is there's a lot of different procedures in different counties. Now, Milwaukee County, for example, typically officers will have the affidavit notarized between each other. The affidavit is then emailed to the judge. The judge never really has personal contact by phone or face-to-face with the affiant. The affidavit's typically emailed to the judge. The judge will review it, issue back a search warrant by email. And what happened in my case, now there's also counties, Waukesha County, I'm typically see them do it by telephone, where there's a record, you can hear the affiant on the phone because there's a recording that will be supplied to the defense where I can hear the judge place the affiant, you know, under oath, right, on, you know, the telephonic recording. What occurred in this case was because I read...
Counsel, I just want to jump in. I have some questions. Putting aside the specifics of your client's case for a minute, though obviously they're relevant to the inquiry, What exactly are you forwarding to us should be a rule that would be adopted, a framework for analyzing these types of questions? What's required, what's not required?
Mm-hmm. So I believe what's required for a minimum requirement to fulfill the Fourth Amendment oath requirement that a search warrant shall be issued upon oath and probable cause is there has to be a showing of a manifest intent to be bound by the affiant, and that equates to a showing for a need for truthfulness with the affiant. And I believe number two, which is very important, is the affiant has to be able to be held responsible for false swearing or perjury as a result of the system that's in place.
Go ahead.
Sorry, just a quick follow-up. So it is not your position that there needs to be an oral oral swearing. Is that correct?
That's correct.
It's not your position that it needs to be directly before a magistrate. It could go through an intermediary, as it did here, another officer who notarizes and then goes to a magistrate.
That's correct, Justice. I believe State versus Ty makes very clear an oath is a matter of substance, not form. Mm-hmm. But State versus Ty also makes clear that an oath is there to impress upon the conscience of the individual the seriousness of the event. There has to be solemnity right to the event. And that State versus Ty also says that the purpose of an oath is also that that person can be held responsible for perjury or false swearing.
So looking at this specific affidavit, which is in the appendix,
When the officer said, being first duly sworn on oath, deposes and says, do you believe that this officer could be held responsible if he perjured himself?
That's why I believe that this court should reverse the motion. I do not believe that that officer could be held responsible for perjury or false swearing.
So you don't think that the solemnity was demonstrated by those words, being first duly sworn on oath?
I don't believe so, because in this case, and I also want to quote the jury instruction, because I have researched the jury instructions, and as a defense attorney, I know that when you go to trial, if I was representing that officer, let's say he was charged for perjury or false swearing, perjury in this state of Wisconsin, and that's another thing I wanted to make sure I'm clear in this oral argument, is that the other cases that the state cited in their brief, I'll get into that. Most of those cases from New Mexico, from Texas, that interpret how this is applied in their state, has to interpret it by their state law as to whether their state law could actually charge that affiant with perjury under their state law system. In Wisconsin, perjury really only is applicable if the person lies under oath orally in a court proceeding.
So false swearing
would be the issue. And I wanted to say in the jury instruction for false swearing, it says, element number two, use the following if written statements are involved. It says a written statement is under oath when it is subscribed or signed by a person who swears that it is the truth before some person authorized to administer an oath. So, I mean, it's right there in the elements of the offense under the jury instructions.
So what do you mean it's right there? So they said they were being first duly sworn on oath, deposes and says, and then the second paragraph says that all this is true, and then he signed it in the presence of a person who can do that, this notary, who said, subscribed and sworn to me and gives the date and has his signature. So what part of the jury instruction element is not met here?
Right, the part where it says, who swears that it is the truth. The document said being first duly sworn on oath. The document contemplated an oral oath occurring. The document does not say, I hereby, by my signature, swear that the contents are true, understanding the penalty of perjury is there. The document itself doesn't say that. The document says being first duly sworn on oath. Not only that, the Portage County Sheriff's Office admitted that their policy of not swearing an oath under their system was an erroneous policy. So, I mean, if I was defending that client at a perjury trial, I would say, well, it's not the affiant's fault, really. It's the notary's. The notary, in this matter, did not do his job. He never swore in that officer, which was his duty to do. His duty was not to simply notarize that document. That was an affidavit. To protect the solemnity of that event, that notary had a duty to swear in that officer.
So the words, what would be the words that would be okay if these words aren't? You're saying something like, what would it have to say at the beginning? Let's say that there's no oral oath given at all. What would the first part have to say?
If there's no oral oath given at all, then I believe one example which would create, I believe, a more difficult scenario for me to try to argue against it would be if the language made very clear that the person signing it understood that it was under oath. For example, I hereby, by my signature, swear that the following facts contained in this affidavit are true and correct to the best of my knowledge, with full understanding if the penalties of false swearing in the state of Wisconsin. I believe that would be a different scenario than what we have before us. But it's still difficult, in my opinion, to get around the fact that our system for false swearing is pretty clear, that the person has to swear to the document. Who swears to it is the truth.
This is a bread and butter thing, right? By that I mean it's got to be clear. I'm a little concerned about whether or not it impresses the solemnity of the occasion. Tell me if it impresses the solemnity of the occasion. I don't know. I mean, so we need, by that I mean, what's solemn to one may not be so solemn to another. We need bright line rules in this kind of a thing. Do you think that the constitutional mandate of you need an oath, it has to be a verbal oath?
From what I've read in the case law, It's the case law began with Atwood versus Mississippi in this area, which is a 1920 case. What I believe, yeah, Justice, I'm sorry. I mean, I believe an oath is a matter of substance, not form. I believe at the current state of Wisconsin law, if you're the only way to charge somebody with false swearing, it seems, and to prevail, it seems, is that it says in the elements of the jury instructions that who swears that it is the truth. So, I mean, I don't know. It doesn't contemplate constructive language in the affidavit itself. So, I mean, that makes it difficult to say an oral oath is not required. But the basic Fourth Amendment law does state that an oath is a matter of substance, not form.
Okay, I understand that. That, mm-hmm. that times is as amorphous. Sometimes a form can become substance. So,
right.
The answer to my question is what? Does it have to be oral?
I don't believe it is absolute requirement that an oath has to be oral.
Thus, it can be written. That's the
it can be written.
Implication of my
yes.
of the answer. Are there, you, in giving an example, you indicated, you know, this I give by penalty of perjury, blah, I don't mean blah, 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 because this
no.
is more important than that, and I don't mean to be disrespectful, but I mean,
understood.
I couldn't think of the remaining part of what you said, so that's why I said blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Is it sufficient to say, I, Max Brainerd, solemnly swear that, and then pick up the words that are in existence in the affidavit, and only those words. In other words, I, Max Brainerd, solemnly swear, number one, I'm a certified law enforcement officer. Number two, I have personal knowledge. Just follow what's already there. Without your under pain and penalty of perjury language, would that be sufficient?
So is the question then, if basically the first line of the affidavit said, instead of being first duly sworn on oath, I hereby swear?
Or, I do solemnly swear, I swear, I hereby swear, a written oath in that regard.
It could possibly be, I believe, if the affiant is aware that their signature is the oath. So, I mean, if the affidavit said, I hereby solemnly swear by my signature.
Why does it have to say by my signature? I do solemnly swear. I mean, these are law enforcement officers. Or you don't even need a law enforcement officer. I think most people in high school, if they say, I do solemnly swear, understand what that means.
Right. The reason why I was suggesting the language of by my signature, I believe there has to be something that stands out to not make this routine. I understand because I believe this process, the whole point of an oath, every time a witness comes into court, they have to swear an oath. Those police officers witness routine witnesses, right? Why do we make them swear every time? Because they have to understand that what they're doing is not routine. What they're doing is a serious event. There has to be something that stands out to impress upon their conscience. An oral oath is, as the Portage County Sheriff's Office admitted in this case, would have been the proper way of doing it. And I'll say this. There's a case that the state cited in their brief, Kellner versus Christian. This is a Wisconsin Supreme Court case, which dealt with notice of claims. Now, in that case, this court enunciated principles to discern what an oath is. And I believe that that case is also instructive. In the first two principles in that case, a solemn declaration, manifest intent to be bound, I believe that is what is required. That case was a notice of claim case, though. And that case dealt with civil cases when people are claimants are trying to sue government employees, basically. So in that case, what was required, too, was a signature on the document and an acknowledgement that the document was sworn in order for the Attorney General to effectively process those claims. I believe in this case, the minimum requirement is the first two elements. I don't believe those first two elements were that they're not present in the facts of this particular case. And that is because What I believe is that, for example, had in my case, if you really analyze this case, had the officer sworn oral oath but had forgotten to sign the affidavit, I believe the affidavit would still be considered a sworn statement. I believe the lack of signature would be a technical irregularity, and it would not consider it unsworn. So I believe the oath, and the oath is something that has to stand out in the affidavit. There has to be an oral statement. There has to be something that equates to being able to charge that affiant with false swearing.
Why couldn't you charge him with false swearing if the facts in the affidavit, him being Sergeant Brown, he says being first duly sworn on oath, deposes and says, why isn't that sufficient to be a statement given on oath? He says on oath.
Right, because it's not true. He was never first duly sworn on oath. It says that, but it never occurred.
Well, yes and no. I mean, if you can do it in writing, it occurred. And I read, is it the Thai case? There was one that I thought was really, really helpful. And basically what it says is that a matter of oath is, yeah, it was Thai, T-Y-E, is a matter of substance, not a matter of form. So if he in substance says it, which it sounds to me like that's what he's saying, why aren't you changing to a matter of form by your argument and ignoring the substance that's present in a written form?
I'm not changing it to a matter of form. It is substantive. The substance was never there. The document said being first duly sworn on oath, and that the notary never swore him.
But you don't think he can say that knowing that his statement after he makes it is going to be subject to a okay, which this was, and he says, being first, duly sworn on oath. Why can't he say he has been in writing?
Because I believe the language, the way that I interpreted that language, the way I think that most people would interpret it, and that the subjective opinion of that officer really is not relevant. What's relevant is if there's a manifest intent to be bound.
But why isn't that a manifest intent? Because it's written in writing rather than said out loud.
Because it's pre-printed language. The officer wrote his name next to it. Mm-hmm. That becomes routine, being first duly sworn on oath. When the Portage County Sheriff's Office admitted this is an erroneous policy, he should have sworn an oral oath. They admitted that. And that's because the document itself...
They admit whatever they like, but if it's a question of law, it doesn't do them much good up here, right?
Right.
Facts might help them, but not... questions of law, and this certainly is a legal question.
Right, but I'll say this. I believe that the document itself contemplated an oral oath being sworn. And this officer was audio recorded. I was able to hear the audio recording, and I was able to show that there was no oath administered by the notary.
No, I don't think that there's a dispute about what you're saying. I don't think that there was an oral oath administered. But when he's asked to sign something and swear to it and does go do it, why isn't that an affirmation of the oath? By his actions.
Right, because I believe his actions were not enough. Not enough in this case. Because, like as I said, I don't believe you'd prevail on an action against him for false swearing. So he's not bound by it. So he's not bound.
Well, I don't know that I agree with that. So that's another legal conclusion.
Mm-hmm. And I'll say this, Justice. One case that stood out to me was... was a case cited by actually the state in their brief. And in that case, Blackburn versus Motor Vehicles Division, Department of Transportation, this was an Oregon case, 33 ORAPP 397. On page 404 of the opinion, they discussed how the situation would apply under Oregon law. In that case, there was no oral oath administered, similar facts to this case. And what stood out to me was that they cited that in the state of Oregon that It's no defense to a prosecution for perjury or false swearing, and they cited Oregon law, which stated that the oath or affirmation was taken or administered in an irregular manner. Oregon had written that into their law, that there's no defense to perjury, that the oath or affirmation was taken or administered in an irregular manner. We don't have that in Wisconsin law.
Counsel, I want to just follow up on Justice Rogan-Sack's question. And I may be mishearing you or misunderstanding you, so maybe you can connect the dots for me a little bit. But it sounded like argument was a little circular to me. It sounded like you were saying that the written being first duly sworn isn't sufficient because he couldn't be charged with perjury. But then I felt like you were saying before he couldn't be charged with perjury because he didn't swear. And so I'm trying to figure out... Yeah, maybe you can, just any response to that, can you help me out with the argument you're making there?
Right. I believe the current state of the Wisconsin law for false swearing is that it appears to me from the jury instructions that it requires the person to swear to the document.
And to swear what?
To affirmatively swear to the document.
Right. So does, in the end, it all goes back to how you read the document.
Right. I believe okay. So. This yep. document...
If you read it the way Justice Rogan-Sack is proposing reading it, she's giving a reading of the document that suggests that what's written here constitutes exactly what you're saying. Would you agree that if that's a reasonable way to read it, or what sort of standard of exactitude you might apply to it, that would be enough to constitute perjury?
If that... In my case, that could the officer be charged with perjury or false
swearing?
Correct.
Right. Question? Under Justice Rogan-Sack is saying, being right. first duly sworn, you know, and going on from there, that language that's in your particular client's case, that itself constitutes the oath.
I don't think there's a chance to prove that man guilty beyond a reasonable doubt if you tried that affiant under that law, and you showed the jury what the affidavit said, I thought the jury would ask, was he sworn or not? And the response is no. Because the document says being first duly sworn on oath. I don't believe there'd be a chance the state could prevail in that situation.
So you're reading it to say, I was first sworn on oath before I made this document. And what I think Justice Hagedorn and Justice Rogan-Sack and what I'm asking is, can't you read this a different way to say, before I sign this, I am recognizing or acknowledging that I am duly sworn on oath? And you're saying you don't need an oral oath, so why can't that be what it says, as opposed to, first I was sworn on oral oath, and then I filled out this form, which is how you're reading it. Why can't it have the alternate reading?
Because I believe that it's clear it says being first duly sworn. Those words being first duly sworn contemplate that he was sworn before he made those statements. Meaning
right. He understood the solemnity, and before making the statements, he understood, and isn't that the point of it when we're saying it's not, that it's the substance that those words could accomplish. I think we're not going to agree, but I think there's more than one way to potentially read the language is the point.
Right, but for an oath, I mean, I think it's got to be clear that the affiant was sworn, and I don't think it should be ambiguous.
You know, I think if you look at the affidavit as something that's written seriatim, and to understand seriatim, not just all at once, you'll see that in the third paragraph he says, I have personal knowledge that the contents of this affidavit are true, and that any observations or conclusions from fellow officers referred in this affidavit are truthful. Okay, so these are, if those statements were not truthful by the officer, you certainly could hold him, try him for perjury for making those statements that would be false. I mean, if he never talked to any other officer, if he put things in the affidavit that he had no personal knowledge of, why couldn't you try him on perjury under paragraph 3?
Because, I think to try him on perjury, you'd have to include the element that he was under oath,
well,
that he was sworn.
What I was asking you to suppose is that you read the affidavit seriatim. Okay, so you read the first sentence first. That takes care of whatever the first sentence says. And then you move into the affidavit. And certainly, if you read it as substantively his saying, being first duly sworn upon oath, what he's telling the reader is, I was sworn on oath, and he's writing it down there. Okay, this is how he's being sworn, is by his writing on oath. So if it's a matter of substance, why can't he be sworn by his writing rather than by his voice?
Because the way that that document is printed, it says being first duly sworn. I don't believe that's enough to stand out. It doesn't really equate to the solemnity of this event. This event should stand out in the officer's mind. Plus, the language you read there was pre-printed language. I have personal knowledge that this is true. No officer I understand it lies. No citizen witness lies. That's pre-printed language, boilerplate language, in a template affidavit. He didn't handwrite that in. He never typed that in.
No, of course he didn't. And you do realize that if you could do nothing, you couldn't type an affidavit, you couldn't do anything without first putting this man under oath, then how is he going to swear to this when he's not read it either? I mean, the affidavits are put together back at the station house,
right.
And the guy on the beat is the one that's got to, you know, arrest someone for driving under the influence.
Right. Just all I will say is we have to remember it was the notary, not the affiant. It was the notary's job to swear in this individual, and he never did that.
Okay.
And that's where the failure is in this case. I believe that really, how can you say it was a solemn event when the notary failed to do his job? And how could you charge him with perjury when the notary failed to do his job? He wasn't sworn.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel?
Good afternoon, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. Assistant Attorney General John Kellis, appearing on behalf of the State of Wisconsin. In State versus Tye, this Court recognized that an oath is a matter of substance and not form. Yet, for the last 25 minutes, we've been discussing form and not substance. I'm asking that you stay true to Tye's holding, decline to impose needless rules that would elevate form over function, and join the Court of Appeals in holding that the warrant for Mr. Mosier's blood was duly supported by oath or affirmation. To convince you that you should honor that request, I wish to really address two overarching issues here today. First is to explain why the warrant for Mosier's blood passed constitutional muster, because the process by which it was secured impressed upon Sergeant Brown the need to tell the truth. Second, I'll explain why the oath or affirmation requirement was satisfied, notwithstanding Mosier's three primary counterarguments, which largely focus on terminology, which has been largely the focus here today, the identity of the person who sent the affidavit to the court, and the police department, I guess, policy regarding the administering of an oath. Now, in Tye, this court reaffirmed the essential role or roles that the oaths play in obtaining a valid search warrant. And the state wholeheartedly agrees with that. Oaths serve very important goals. They remind the applicant and the magistrate the importance of the application process. They impress upon police an obligation to tell the truth. And they protect the targets of searches by creating liability for false swearing. Now, neither the state nor federal constitution define what an oath requires. And because of that, courts all across the country have refused to adopt rigid rules governing how an oath or an affirmation must be administered. Instead, courts recognize, and it appears that the parties are generally in agreement on this, that when an affiant manifests intent to be under oath, under circumstances that impress the need to tell the truth, they are effectively under oath. Some courts have defined oaths more succinctly. This court did so outside of the search warrant context in Kellner, which in turn cited McKnight, a Utah Supreme Court case. But it's important to note that even the source, McKnight, pointed to no authority suggesting why an oath required those four things.
Counsel, I'm going to approach this in a more simplistic fashion. And again, look at the language of this document. Which I have hesitation about, because I think what is being said is not accurate. It says, Sergeant Steve Brown, being first duly sworn on oath. You can look at, like, first, I'm going to say this. Sworn is a past participle, means something in the past, right?
Yes.
I would have little problem, or I would see this differently if it stated, Sergeant Steve Brown, swear, you know, and state as follows. But this says it happened in the past. It happened first. Before I did this, sworn is a past word. And it didn't happen. Who swore him?
Okay.
Who swore him in the past?
Okay. There's a couple of things, Justice Bradley, in my response to that. First is that, and I think this has kind of been acknowledged during counsel's argument, that when Sergeant Brown is filling out this document, he's not already sworn at that time. And that's not something that I'm here to say that he was. It's not as though someone was expected to swear him or administer an affirmation and then sit there and watch him as he fills out this document piece by piece. How I read this affidavit is this, you have an individual who is prepared to provide information to a court in support of a request for a search warrant. He's providing his name, and he's filling out this information with the recognition that at the end of this document, he is going to sign this document, and in doing so, he is going to be swearing or affirming the contents of this document. So the fact that the affidavit begins next to his name and starts being duly sworn on oath, deposes and says, I don't disagree. It's not that he is under oath at that particular moment. What I'm saying is that by the time he fills this document out and finishes it and he's ready to submit it, the act of signing it and having a notary take that at that point, that is the act of him swearing or affirming the contents of it.
So an oath, the oath here occurred when he signed his name. Is that what you're saying?
Effectively, when he's signing it and submitting it for review, correct.
How does that... Now, we're dealing with something really important. We're dealing with something really important that is the constitutional mandate that the affidavit be under oath or affirmation. So that makes it important. What's troublesome to me is, you know, it's these little words. But the concept is exceedingly important. So where do you find, either in the statutes or a case law, authority for your assertion that an oath is taken upon the signature of the person? Maybe it's a plenty, but... you're saying it's in the signature. What does the notary say? Subscribed, which means in the signature, and sworn to. That seems different than the signature. It's different than subscribe. But you're advancing that, no, the oath is the subscription. So where do I go from here?
I guess there's a few different sources.
Okay.
The fact that in Kellner, at the very least, when we're defining what an oath or the requirements of an oath, one of those is, I mean, we have the solemn declaration, the manifestation of the intent to be bound by the statement, the signature of the declarer, and the acknowledgement by the authorized person that the oath was taken. Now, if the oath, I guess if there was some requirement that there was an oath before the declaration of the manifestation of the intent, it would seem to be really confusing and kind of circular And that's, I guess, where I take that is that, you know, Kellner would support that as well, given the fact that one of the requirements of the oath is the actual act of the signature. But not only that, you know, the state has highlighted numerous cases throughout the country in which individuals have done precisely what Sergeant Brown did in this case, and courts have recognized that that act, the preparation of that affidavit and the signature and providing that to the court was the act of swearing or affirming the contents of it.
So how far does this go? Now you're saying you don't need any language at all in there other than the signature. So if it didn't say being first duly sworn and it didn't say I have personal knowledge about this, is that enough?
I disagree because I think really there are different parts to it, really. And it's not just a matter of I signed a document in front of a notary and there's no indication from the document that I intended for any of this to be true or that I was holding it out to be the truth. I think that falls victim to, you know, these foundational principles of what an oath or affirmation is. And that's, I think, probably the most convincing case that Mr. Mosier has advanced or presented to this court was out of the Court of Appeals of Texas. And it had to do with basically there being just this document that contains no indication that the affiant actually intended to stand by any of the information that was presented. And that's what sets this apart. I mean, in this case, we have a sergeant who's explaining very early on in the affidavit, I have personal knowledge of the contents of this document, and they're true.
So it's not just the signature. Now you're arguing something different. I heard you say before it's his signature, this other stuff doesn't matter, but you're acknowledging that it all matters, right? That this is about the acknowledgement of the truth, the understanding you're doing it as the truth, and then you're signing it in front of a notary. So all those things are part and parcel.
And I should be clear, Your Honor, and my apologies, it's not simply just the matter of signing it. The reason why I brought this up is that there's this question about, well, if he writes his name next to a field that says that he was being first duly sworn, that is either a lie on his part or that the oath or the affirmation hasn't existed yet. And what I'm saying is that the combination of including information in an affidavit saying this information is true and that I have personal knowledge of all of this and that I, when you have these representations within the text of the document that indicate that they understand this procedure, that they recognize that this information is going to be relied on by the court, and they finish this all by signing the document and subscribing to the, just by even signing the document at the very end, they are representing that this information can be relied on. So it isn't just the signature and to the
it really isn't the signature at all, is it? I mean, we have to go back to this is a constitutional requirement, oath or affirmation upon probable cause, right? Supported by probable cause. So there's nothing in the Constitution that requires a signature, and of course I think both of you would agree that it would be sufficient if there wasn't an affidavit for this officer to provide sworn testimony by telephone to a magistrate or a judge, right?
Correct.
So what I'm interested in is what did the Fourth Amendment originally mean when it spoke to supported by oath or affirmation, and what was the underlying principle? What was the whole purpose of the Fourth Amendment? It was to protect the people from having their papers, their property, their person searched unfettered by government officials. And so there has to be a means of making government officials accountable if they violate the Fourth Amendment. The only way to do that, to hold them accountable, is this concept of perjury. Now, your friend on the other side is making the argument that under this affidavit, this officer could not be held accountable if he was providing false information to the court. So could you address that argument, please?
Absolutely. It's probably no surprise that the state disagrees with that interpretation and that perjury could not have been charged. I misspeak. Perjury could not be charged. This was not an oral statement. If anything, it would be false swearing. But I disagree that Sergeant Brown could not be charged with false swearing if he knowingly included information in this document that was false. Now, granted, this is admittedly very circular in that to question whether someone could be charged in this situation, if you operate with the assumption that this wasn't a swearing or an affirmation, then I guess that's what the evidence would have to show. I mean, ultimately, the state would have to present evidence to show that this individual intended to represent this, that they were affirming, that they were taking it upon themselves to make an oath. And the context of that, I mean, would rely on the contents of this document. And potentially a jury might look at it and say, well, because he used this first duly sworn versus I solemnly swear, maybe he didn't mean to do that. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me that would be a defense to a false swearing charge. And I fully expect that if it were established that Sergeant Brown actually knew that some of the information in this document was false and he still presented it to the court the way he did, that he would be able to be charged with false swearing. But again, it is somewhat circular, and I recognize that because we're talking about, well, is it an oath or affirmation? Because if it is, then he can be charged with false swearing, but he can only be charged with false swearing if it's an oath or affirmation. I mean, I get that it is somewhat redundant, but I have little question that if a jury was presented evidence that Sergeant Steve Brown provided this document to the court with indications saying first duly sworn on oath and saying that he has personal knowledge of the contents and signing the document at the end next to a notary jurat that indicates that it was subscribed and sworn to, I highly doubt that any jury would look at this and think, well, there really wasn't an oath or affirmation.
So what should we... I'm going to ask a follow-up. What should we be telling police departments?
Well, Justice Skrofsky, there's been a discussion in even in the party's briefs, and I think the Court of Appeals recognized this, and many of the courts that have upheld search warrants in these cases have also recognized that there's a difference between the best practice or better practice and what the Fourth Amendment demands. Certainly in a verbal oath of some sort or affirmation, had that occurred in this case, we obviously wouldn't be here today. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the Fourth Amendment requires that. So I think that it's maybe best practice to have some type of overt act. But I don't think that is necessarily a requirement. It certainly doesn't flow from the Constitution that it has to be done a certain way. As long as there is some action by the affiant to demonstrate that they understand how serious this proceeding is and they intend to stick by their statements.
So, I worked at DOJ and we did best practice all the time, right? Helping as a training, right? Like, this is what we think you should do. It's the best practice. I mean, we might put that in opinion. I kind of doubt it, and I'm guessing if we do, no one's going to do it. I mean, it's just sort of like I don't. So
no,
I mean, you're kind of asking us just to do away with it. I don't know how else you argue it.
I don't know if there is going to be a one size fit all rule. And trust me, if I had one that says this is the way that any individual can demonstrate unequivocally that they intended to be sworn on oath or that they intended to take an affirmation, I don't know if there is a bright line rule that will all encompass that and will provide the guidance that courts may have wanted or that lower courts may have wanted and that police departments would want. I think when there is evidence in the record to suggest that an individual understood the nature of the proceeding and was impressed to tell the truth based on the contents of an affidavit and just in the general, whether there is an oral oath or oral statements being made or whether it's just based on the affidavit, the affiant understood the need to provide only accurate information, then I think the Fourth Amendment is satisfied.
Counsel, suppose this affidavit didn't have the language first duly sworn on oath. Does that change anything for you?
I think the question might be closer as far as whether what Sergeant Brown's intent was. Now, certainly we could still be here arguing that he still intended to represent that all this information was accurate and that he intended to stand by it. But I don't think it's just a make or break if had he not used those specific words, being first duly sworn on oath. I mean, ultimately what you have, though, is an individual who prepared an affidavit that very clearly specified that he had personal knowledge of the information that was included in that, and that he was representing that to be true with the full understanding that this document was going to be provided to a court and relied on to justify issuing a search warrant. Without that, I mean, I think that would still hold true whether or not he used that specific language, being first duly sworn on oath. And I think it's also,
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I think that's also consistent with the various cases that the state had cited within its brief, that some of which included that language, the language that largely mirrored Mr. Mosier's affidavit about being duly sworn and things like that. But others in which it was just the very process of bringing forth an affidavit to a magistrate and presenting that to them, recognizing that I need to provide true information and that this is a serious proceeding and this is the reason why I'm giving it to you.
Suppose there's been a couple of, you know, readings of the being first duly sworn part. And I know, you know, there's still the subscribed and sworn to at the end, I suppose. I don't know additional work that does here, but I understand your broader argument. Suppose the reading of being first duly sworn is, as your opposing counsel says, that maybe at some time, maybe in years past, there really was an oral oath that was given that was just dispensed with somewhere along the line, and the language is what it is, but it's not accurate in terms of what is occurring here. Obviously, we know here no oral oath was given, which I think is somewhat unique among the cases, and that we have, you know, the sort of oral evidence of what did or didn't occur. But suppose, again, that the better reading of this, of that language, is that this is not quite accurate. Does that change your argument at all?
I don't think it necessarily does, in that, I mean, if we look to the authority that interprets, like, what the Fourth Amendment really requires, and one of the main cases that we relied on in the Court of Appeals is United States versus Brooks, that recognizes that, you know, even without a ceremony, even without, a specific procedure or an oral oath or anything like that, that when an individual takes it upon himself and basically, I don't want to go so far as to say walks like a duck, talks like a duck, but if you're providing all this information, you're going through these procedures as though you would have if you were being placed under oath, and you're representing this and you're handing this document over that says that you're being under oath, I mean, it's the really the party's manifested intent to be under oath under it.
So just so I can make sure I understand your argument, that language, regardless of how you read it, even if there's a technical defect in or some dissonance between the language and the process, even if that's the better reading, you're saying, listen, there was an overt act, there was, you know, in some sense, by the writing here, this was being prepared for a magistrate, and all of that by itself, regardless of how you read that first initial language or how it's best read, that is sufficient to constitute the kind of solemnity and promises and possible penalties associated with the oath requirement.
I think it does, Your Honor, and I think to hold any other way is to really, again, elevate form over function. It really is to say that in this particular case, Mr. Mosier's blood should be suppressed if it says being first duly sworn, but it shouldn't be suppressed if it says I swear under oath, deposed say.
But what you're saying then in response to Justice Hagedorn is you don't need any of it. It's the mere fact of being prepared for a magistrate that makes it the oath that meets the constitutional requirement, and therefore we're never going to question anything officers do in terms of signing affidavits. Hey, maybe you don't even need the signature. So we're just going to say officers can just send, as long as they're sending it to a magistrate, that's enough.
I mean,
where are the lines here? Is that what you're saying?
I don't agree. No. I don't think it's a matter of just taking any particular document, unsigned, whatever the contents are, handing it over to the judge and saying, look at this. I don't think that that's what we're asking for here. It's when they present a document that has the contents of which reveals that the individual understands what the process is and that they intend to make truthful statements that are being presented in anticipation of a search warrant being issued, that is sufficient.
So that it does matter that it has words like, duly sworn, that it has words like, I have personal knowledge that the contents are true, and not particular words per se, but in order to manifest this intent, there needs to be those types of words.
I think you hit the nail on the head when you said not this are particular words, because I think that that's really what this case is about, is a matter of, if we're talking about form and function, if we're talking about potentially suppressing evidence in a case because of the order of the words in the first line of an affidavit, I think that's problematic. Now, if an affidavit on its face and as a whole provides sufficient information for a court to recognize that the officer understands what this proceeding is and that they intend to make these statements truthfully in anticipation of a search warrant being issued, I think the Fourth Amendment then is satisfied. And I think that the body of – I'm sorry.
But it's more than that, counsel, and I'm going to go back to my earlier question and push you a little bit on it, because if we look at the definition of an oath under Black's Law Dictionary, it's not the form or even the substance. It's what is the legal effect of the oath? And Black's Law Dictionary says the legal effect of an oath is to subject the person to penalties for perjury if the testimony is false. And you've also relied on Professor Lefebvre's criminal procedure treatise for the principles you're espousing, but he went on to say the true test for deciding if an officer has made an oath is whether the procedures followed were such that perjury could be charged if any material allegation is false. So do you disagree with that proposition that it is the effect of the oath, not just what the officer intended, of course, because we can't get into the officer's mind. It's whether that officer is going to be held accountable for making a false statement of fact.
And I agree with that. I understand that. I guess the issue that we're going to run into, or that we continue to run into, is this circular logic of if it is an oath or affirmation, they could be charged with it, but they could only be charged with it if it's an oath or affirmation. And I think when you look at the contents of this information, it meets the bar of establishing that this individual came forward, he provided this information, he assured the court that it was true. I don't know how Sergeant Brown could not be prosecuted for false swearing if it were ultimately determined that any of the contents in this document.
Because he would have lied to the judge, fundamentally, right?
Correct. I mean, the information, if he provides anything in this document that is inaccurate and he realizes this was going to be presented and he signs his name on this indicating that it's true and he signs it right next to a notary jurat that indicates that he's subscribing and swearing to it,
Counsel, I have two problems with your approach that I need help with. You say it depends on his intent. Isn't intent generally a question of fact?
Yes, I suppose so.
Yeah, that's a little bit of a problem, maybe. And the second is, if he intends to impress, you say, to make truthful statements, and yet at the outset, what is being said is, in my mind, not accurate. I could be so bold to say is not true that he was sworn in the past, having first been duly sworn. So there's a little dissonance here on your embracing that everything has to be true when I, maybe my colleagues don't, but have a little difficulty saying that those first couple of words are accurate. And I also have difficulty if this also all boils down to the person's intent, because generally the intent would be considered a factual determination. Perhaps it isn't here. Maybe I'm wrong, but generally. So how do you deal with all of that?
So I guess two things. First, and this is something that I maybe I just will not be able to convince Your Honor.
Maybe. I don't know. My colleagues but, might have to convince me one way or the other. It'll be an interesting conference.
I understand your reading of the affidavit. I don't believe that to be false. Saying when the individual signs or writes their name at the beginning, indicating being first duly sworn on oath, and has all of this information, and they're filling it out in the process of it. I don't think that this affidavit, or really any affidavit for that matter, contemplates that the person, before they even begin filling out the document, is going to be asked to hold their hand up and swear, and then proceed to fill out all the document. As far as the... So I don't think that this is inaccurate, or false or misleading or anything like that. As far as the court's second concern, and my apologies, I...
Factual determination.
As far as there being a factual determination, I mean, certainly a witness could be called to testify in those situations to describe what it was that what was going through their minds at that particular time. But I think... Above all, when you review the affidavit and review the circumstances in which this person applied for a search warrant, it's hard to gather or fathom how an individual who fills out a document indicating that they're being duly sworn and indicating that they are providing, that they're attesting to the fact that they have personal knowledge, and then signing at the end of the document saying that they are subscribing and swearing to this, that person would have any other belief but the fact that they are, in fact, swearing or attesting to whatever is included in that document. So I just wanted to, I guess, resolve just a few more matters with my remaining time. With all the arguments between the parties, really there's not a very large gap between the positions in that, at least it was my understanding that the parties, I'm sorry, it looks like my time is up, so.
You can finish your statement.
There is not a particularly large gap between the parties in that we all agree that the Fourth Amendment doesn't require an oral oath, and that language and demeanor and conduct can manifest the intention to be under oath. It's just a matter of whether the verb tense, not presenting the judge the document, and the policy of the agency is enough to show that he didn't intend to swear or affirm these contents. And I think, based on the record that was there, that the court was correct to deny the suppression motion, and the Court of Appeals was correct to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
Okay, am I ready? Okay. Thank you. I do believe in this case that in order to demonstrate that an oath was administered, an oral oath was required. But I don't believe that for Fourth Amendment basic principles across the board, I'm not arguing across the board, that an oral oath is required every single time to mete out the Fourth Amendment. Because the Fourth Amendment says that an oath is a matter of substance, not form. A particular form is not required. Furthermore, I want to be clear. The jury instruction 1756 for false swearing, I believe it is required that you should be able to charge the person, and it should be pretty obvious that third element is meant for false swearing. In order for this court to hold that an oath was administered. And in 1756, the jury instruction, it doesn't say, did the affiant raise his hand and say anything in particular? It does say, though, he has to swear that it is the truth before some person authorized to administer an oath. So, I mean, I don't think we have to go so far as to say he didn't raise his hand, he didn't say a certain script, but he has to swear that it is the truth before some person authorized to administer an oath. That would be how the state could prevail against that person, and that is required. in order to demonstrate that there's an oath. I don't think if we don't require that, then we dispense with the oath provision under the Fourth Amendment altogether. Furthermore, I just wanted to highlight the fact that in the Brooks case, U.S. versus Brooks, there's two big differences between our case, Mr. Moser's case, and the Brooks case. In the Brooks case, that affiant personally presented the affidavit to the judge himself. I think when the affiant personally presents the affidavit to the judge himself, that does show a degree of solemnity right there. In the case with Mr. Moser...
Hey, counsel, if this exact situation had happened here, but it was presented directly to the magistrate here, you think that would be sufficient?
No, I'm not saying that, no.
Okay.
Because there's also another thing in Brooks. In Brooks, the officer hand-typed in the affidavit, and this was the language he used. He said, I, Officer Chris Graves, being duly sworn, depose and state as follows. The affidavit was not pre-printed that said, being first duly sworn on oath. Being first duly sworn on oath, I can't read it at anything else but face value, would indicate to me that the person is required to swear an oath outside of the document itself. And that did not occur in this case. And that's the minimum standard of the Fourth Amendment. That person has to be sworn. And so I don't believe that that's the case. But I think it just shows even, it's more extreme, the facts of this case, that the affiant never even went to the commissioner himself. The notary brought it. So the person who wrote this affidavit never even went before the commissioner. And there's not one case. The only cases that the state cited where it was signed by a notary and there's no indication that that person actually presented it to the commissioner, those cases make clear they go through the state law. And in that state's law, they're able to charge the person with perjury. And in the Hodges case that I cited, which is the most similar to this case, it's a Texas Court of Appeals case. I understand it's not a Supreme Court case. It's a Court of Appeals case. But the facts are very similar. The only difference is, as the state highlighted, and I don't believe that's what turned that decision. The only difference in that case is in the Texas case, they said that the affidavit itself didn't include the language of, I understand that all police officers are truthful. That's, you know, that standard boilerplate language that everybody's truthful. It didn't include that, but I don't think it turned on that. What it turned on was this. They analyzed that under Texas law, and they said the affiant can't be charged with perjury under here, but they also highlighted the fact that the affidavit said being first duly sworn, which never occurred. And they had a problem with that. And I believe we have the same problem here. And so I don't think under here that under the facts of this case in particular, I don't think the state has cited, and the state has obviously the burden of proof to prevail in the case like this, but I don't think the state has cited the case law that can demonstrate that facts which occurred under Mr. Moser's situation are enough to meet out the minimum standards of the Fourth Amendment. And I believe that also, because I know we're a lot of discussion is about, well, what principle can we enunciate so that, you know, we have a certain standard here. And I believe the principle is this, is that an affiant must show a manifest intent to be bound by his statement under circumstances that emphasize the need to tell the truth. And that the courts should analyze these cases, and in so doing should analyze the language of the affidavit and the conduct of the affiant. And there has to be a showing that under Wisconsin law, the affiant can be charged with false swearing. And I think that that's the standard that could meet out the Fourth Amendment. That standard itself doesn't require absolutely an oral swearing, I believe in this particular, but it's a fact-by-fact, you know, obviously analysis, case-by-case analysis. And under this case, the only thing that could have saved them would have been if the notary would have placed the affiant under oath, which the notary did not do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Concluded the third oral argument of the day, and the court will convene at 10 after 10.